I don't even think we had school in Yom Kippur on Long Island.
I'm sure you did.
We shut
I'm
down sure for all the holidays. Yeah.
You shut down for like Tzom Gedalia. Right?
Yeah.
Hello, Jews. This is Unorthodox, our third annual Yom Kippur episode. For the past 2 years, we've had special episodes in which we've talked about atonement, apology, all the ways that we make things right at this time of year when the gates of heaven open and hear our prayers. And we're back at you talking about atonement. I'm your deeply guilty host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by only one of my co-hosts, the newlywed Stephanie Butnick. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. It's good to know that Liel has nothing to atone for.
Right. He has so much to atone for. He's like off in the desert wearing a hair shirt and whipping himself.
Vision quest.
Right. He's like on an ayahuasca-fueled vision quest. So we're going to have to carry all the burden of our people ourselves. Well, not ourselves. We're going to be joined by three guests this week. Jew of the Week, Ari Cohen, who runs a blog about bad apologies. He's going to talk to us about what makes an apology truly terrible. Gentile of the Week, Mark Osler, is a former federal prosecutor, and he now works on clemency appeals for prisoners. And he's going to talk about what works or doesn't work when a prisoner is writing a letter to try to get clemency. And we're going to be joined by a friend of the show, Vanessa Zoltan, who is the co-host of the podcast Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. She is going to tell a true story about a family apology that didn't quite take, plus letters from two listeners about their own Yom Kippur pasts. So, Yom Kippur. Stephanie Butnick, what is the holiday season for you?
I actually feel much more aligned calendrically with the Jewish calendar, right? Like this idea of the Jewish New Year in early fall. And as a young person growing up, it makes sense because you're in Hebrew school and the school year is starting. And it actually works really well in like the indoctrination sense. It schedules the year really nicely.
Right.
And then for me, my birthday is in September, so I always felt like it very much was a time of renewal and like a very much a new start. And a lot of the times I would like, my birthday would fall on Yom Kippur and I would just be like such a martyr because I was like 12 and I would like go with my dad to synagogue.
Your birthday would fall on Yom Kippur?
Yeah. And I was just like, this really sets up like an angsty teen to feel very self-righteous.
Right. Look,
what are the other kids doing on their birthday? So yeah, we would go to a temple. I mean, I love that there's a holiday in which we are just sort of forced to look at ourselves and look at the people around us and the way we've treated them. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know that we necessarily would do that. My very good friend Irene, who is a friend of the show, obviously, she...
Obviously. Greek Irene.
She called me last year and she sort of said to me, you know, I wanted to apologize to you when we went on this trip last summer. I was... kind of had this stuff going on. She was apologizing for something I had no idea what she was talking about. You know, I didn't remember. She said, maybe I was cold. And I was like, Irene, are you Yom Kippur-ing me right now? Like, it was this time of year. And she was like, yeah, I was listening to the episode. And it's like, it actually is a really nice thing to stop and think, like, what have I done? Like, what has been... I mean, of course, what always happens is the other person never remembers. I feel like we'll hear more and more of that. Throughout the episode, like, but because I had no idea what she was talking about. But I was like, thank you. This is really meaningful. Because we don't stop in our friendships and our relationships to sort of say, like, what have I done that's upset you? Or what have I done that I feel mixed about inside and that has sort of stayed with me? And or to think about the past year, it's just so powerful.
I also think it's so theologically significant in terms of the way that Judaism is an earthbound religion. It's about what you do here on earth. You know, there's the famous story from the Talmud where God saying, you know, it's not in heaven, it's down with you. Like, you guys figure it out. And I've talked to friends from other traditions, from Islam, from Christianity and others.
Some of your best friends.
Some of my best friends are non-Jews. And I've said, you know, it seems to me that Judaism is the only tradition where atonement is primarily done person to person.
I mean, not we in do, a confession, not in like
right,
booth
not
with
a
God.
Confession booth. Like it's person not that person, you don't yeah. have right. I mean, you have to atone for sins against God as well as sins against people. But clearly, the emphasis in the Yom Kippur season and in atonement generally, and certainly this is true in Maimonides, you have to go to other people and make it right, and then God will say, okay, good enough. But you cannot go into a confession booth and say to a priest, you can't go to your...
Like an anonymous face, basically.
And you have to do it, like, if possible, publicly. Like, Maimonides says you bring witnesses. Like, you really have to say, like, I am making this right to this other human being. And it's one of the only Jewish lessons that I feel like informs my daily life. I mean, when, for example, Sid and I have had a fight and the kids have overheard some of it, or we've had sharp words with each other just in the course of like the morning rush. And it's clear that I was the dick, which is not uncommon.
So do you apologize in front of the kids?
Yes. Yes. I think it's, I mean, not always. I apologize when I get my act together to do it and overcome my own, you know, defensiveness. But if at all possible, I try to say the apology loudly and in front of the kids. Like, I want them to see that that's menschlich behavior, that
yeah.
you apologize to
It's people. Funny because I'm sitting here talking about, like, I love Yom Kippur. I love the high holidays. I actually, when I was abroad in college, I spent one Yom Kippur at Oktoberfest in Munich. And so I just, like, want to, like, you know, put that out there. It was, like, this bizarre experience. I felt uniquely guilty about ever since. But, like, who do I apologize to for that? Is that a God thing?
I don't think you do. I don't think you have to.
But it's like part, you know, it'll be in my, like, memoirs.
Yeah, it's in your, right. You save it for your book. I have a funny college story also about Yom Kippur. I didn't know, I knew growing up when my family, we weren't observant and I knew that Yom Kippur was a fasting day, but I didn't fast and my parents didn't fast. So it wasn't until I got to college that I learned what it was, really. And I learned about the apology tradition because a guy I'd become, you know, sort of friendly with in my first month or two of college, he came to me and he said, I just want to apologize for the fact that I've told a few people I don't really like you very much. And that wasn't nice of me.
And was he like, because it's Yom Kippur, I need to apologize?
Yeah. Maybe he said, in this Yom Kippur season, I'm trying to make amends.
Oh,
and I
no,
realized,
little Mark.
I realized I told a few people I don't like you and I shouldn't have done that. My bad. I'm sorry.
Did he say, like, I do like you?
As I remember the mood of it, I think he was saying, like, I haven't given you a chance. I mean, we were 4 or 5 weeks into college. Like, we didn't know each other, right?
He was, like, funneling a beer as he did this.
Yeah, I think he was saying, like, my bad. Like, let's start anew.
Did you?
Yeah, I mean, we were – I honestly was a little bit shocked. I was trying to figure
out – It's hard to recover from that.
I think I said, you know, dude, don't worry about it. And we were fine. And I saw him – I actually saw him at a synagogue service at a simcha of a relative within the past year or two. And, like, totally awesome guy. I mean, like, there's no bad blood. But it was just funny because he was doing what he thought was the right thing. And, of course, it – you know, and there is always that question
was about it, like, for
apologies.
Him or for you?
Yeah, like
that's a really mean thing to tell you.
Maybe sometimes you let it lie. Maybe sometimes you let it lie.
So,
right?
So do you think he remembers this?
I bet no, because in my experience, the slights that we remember are not the ones other people do, and vice versa.
Yeah, like Irene, it's like no one remembers these tiny things that we hold on to.
Yeah, exactly. So, before we get to Ari Cohen, our first guest, you and I are good, right? Like we don't. Have I wronged you in any way?
Probably, but I think we're pretty much like first of all, you are really interesting because you own up to all, like you sort of let things, I don't know, like we produce a show. It's sort of like a high intensity environment. And
yes.
So there always will be like, why did you do this thing? I thought you should do this thing. Or like, you were supposed to send me this. But I do think we square away pretty much every week.
Yes.
The way this show works. So yeah, are you good with me? Have I done anything?
Totally. No, but I'm good with everyone. I mean, I am totally good with you, but I'm not.
You don't hold grudges.
I'm not. I have many flaws, but I am not a grudge holder. Like, my memory is not good enough to hold grudges.
I've tried to, you know, in my later years, I'm trying to stop holding grudges. It's hard. Like, but what the difference is, like, I remember this one, the person from high school who I'm like, that's the person I hate. Like, that's my takeaway
right,
from, like,
right, right.
I don't hate all these other stupid people. That's the girl who wronged me. And that's the one person I'm going to, like, just never want to ever talk to again. But, like, that doesn't affect my daily life. And I've narrowed it down to just one person. And, like, she encapsulates all the bad things.
And you don't see her. You
don't, oh, no.
Like,
I don't
just
see
a figure
most people from Great Neck.
All right. Well, I'm glad we're good. Well, Happy New Year. Should we get to a guest?
Yeah, sure.
Tell me, baby, what can I say, dear, after I say I'm sorry? So, so sorry. What can I do to prove it to you I'm sorry? Oh, I didn't mean to ever be mean to you.
Our Jew of the Week is Ari Cohen, Cohen with a K. He teaches political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and for years he blogged about terrible public apologies. Welcome to the show, Ari.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so tell us about this blog. You don't keep up the blog anymore, and maybe you'll tell us why, but tell us about the blog and how you started, how you got the idea of cataloging terrible public apologies.
Sure. So the first class I ever taught when I was a graduate student was a class on rhetoric. And we ended up talking a lot in that class about how to effectively make an apology, especially a public apology, if you were someone who was prominent. And this was, you know, many, many years ago. And then back in, I guess it was probably 2012, I was talking with a student of mine in my office hours at Nebraska, and we were talking about terrible apologies that had been in the news. And at that point, the big thing in the news was Geraldo Rivera, who kept trying to apologize for comments he made in the aftermath of the Trayvon Martin shooting. And we were so struck by the fact that he just couldn't or wouldn't get it right. And at that point, the student and I decided together that we were going to start this terrible apologies blog, where we were going to collect these bad apologies, because there seemed to be so many of them.
And so what constitutes a bad apology? When you say he couldn't get it right, what was he not getting right?
Well, there were a variety of things that he got wrong. He kept trying to make excuses for himself. He kept qualifying his apology. You know, he apologized if he offended someone. The second time, he actually didn't apologize at all in his apology, and he said that it was other people's fault, you know, for not really understanding. So, you know, there were a variety of reasons why he got it wrong. And part of it was that I think that, he didn't think that he needed to actually make an apology, but he knew that he had to say the words apology or apologize or forgiveness on the air, right? That was something that was required of him.
Right.
The hard thing about apologies is that they're supposed to be hard. It can't be something that's easy to do, because if it is, it doesn't work.
But what if, like Geraldo, you actually don't think you did something wrong, but you know you have to apologize publicly? A lot of the instances you've documented are people in power sort of saying like, "Ooh, I messed up. I stepped in it. Like, I have to issue a statement." Do they count if you kind of know that this person is just doing it because they have to do it publicly?
If you don't feel bad about what you said or did, if you think that what you said or did was actually correct,
and then other people took it the wrong way or something.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in those cases, issuing a public apology, it's going to ring hollow, because when you say, "Oh, I'm sorry, it offended you," you're doubling down. You're saying, "No, it's you. You're the one that has the problem, not me." In those situations, it might be better not to try to apologize.
Do you have a favorite worst apology from your years of cataloging really bad apologies?
Oh, there are a lot. One of the ones that my student and I talked about at the time, Kanye West's apologies around the Taylor Swift issues that he had. Those were pretty good bad apologies. There are politicians who are exceedingly good at non-apology apologies or at deflecting to somebody else. There was one, gosh, I can't remember his name. He was some local GOP official somewhere who posted on Facebook maybe some racist comments about President Obama. And then he apologized by saying that he was a very committed Republican at the time, which I thought was the strangest excuse for having made racist comments about the president.
I'm actually going to start using that whenever I do anything wrong. Like if I, forget to clean up after my dog in front of a neighbor's house. Later on, I'm going to go back. I was a Republican at the time. That's just going to be my catch-all.
Very committed.
Pass the apologies. Sometimes people do bad things or say something anti-Semitic that it's very clear that they kind of like didn't really get it. And then they'll do their like ADL. They used to do their like Abe Foxman approved apology tour, and they'd study and they'd meet like a Holocaust survivor. How is it hard? Like, it's hard to not be cynical about those efforts. I mean, there was someone like John Galliano who, you know, had like a very anti-Semitic tirade of a bunch of years ago. And then he actually like did all this work. He did the perfunctory meeting with Abe Foxman, but it actually did seem like after a while he really was trying to change, and we just like wouldn't let him off the hook. And there was a time, because at Tablet we were covering this, very important story, and there was a time where we're like, just it's done. Like he did his penance. Like we have to stop bringing this up about him. Like how do we tell what's genuine and what isn't?
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the hardest things for us to figure out. When someone really does sincerely seem to want to change, to atone for bad behavior, when someone seems to have really learned something and is going out of his or her way, I think then you have to say, like, this is someone who really is working to change the behavior and to do better next time. I don't know when the exact point is, right? Like, when you let someone off the hook is going to be, I think up to different people. But I do think it's really important to have that recognition, right? And to say, like, this is someone who is making the change. There's no doubt.
Ari, we owe you an apology. We called you 2 minutes late this morning, and we're really sorry about that.
We also, you had to get up at 7 a.m. for this, and I'm sorry about that.
Right, because you're on the West Coast.
I wouldn't wish that on anyone.
Well, I accept your apology. Thank you very much.
Tell us the name of the blog, and my understanding is that you've let it lapse, and tell us why.
Right. So it was called Terrible Apologies, and there still might be a way to access it. I let that and my own blogging lapse. I did this my blog for a little more than 5 years, and the Terrible Apology blog for probably 3 or 4. But the truth is that blogging, for me anyway, became a lot less fun over the last probably year and a half, because the internet became less of a fun place to exchange ideas for someone with a recognizably Jewish name.
Ari Cohen, you're saying is
you're Jewish?
You've got the K, which really is like added gravitas.
Yeah, Cohen with a K is like feels really biblical.
That's right. Very serious stuff. But it turns out that people love to comment, which was great. I used to have really great conversations with all sorts of people who would drop by and say all sorts of things about various posts. But because I'm a political scientist, it wasn't just apologies I was writing about, but contemporary politics and political philosophy. And the ratio of anti-Semitic comments to interesting comments really changed drastically. And so I'm on hiatus, and perhaps it'll come back at some point.
Sabbatical.
I learned a lot from it. But I'm taking a blogging vacation or sabbatical.
Ari Cohen, we hope you come back. We need you out there cataloging terrible apologies. Obviously, our colleague Marjorie Engel at her blog Sorry Watch also does that. But there's so many terrible apologies. We need you both on that beat. Thank you so much for joining us as our Jew of the Week on this Yom Kippur episode. And we hope you have a sweet, sweet new year.
It was my pleasure. Thank you. And the same to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Our Gentile of the Week for this annual Yom Kippur episode is Mark Osler. He is a professor at the University of St. Thomas Law School in Minnesota, and he's a former federal prosecutor. He now works on clemency. He played a role in striking down the mandatory 100-to-1 ratio between crack and powder cocaine in the federal sentencing guidelines, and he's the author of the 2009 book Jesus on Death Row, which criticizes the American death penalty through the lens of Jesus's trial. Professor Osler, thank you for joining us.
No, it's my pleasure, and it's a perfect time to be talking about this issue.
Absolutely. So let's just start with a little terminology. Clemency, pardon, commutation, what are these different terms? What do they mean? And what do they morally imply?
Sure. There's a lot of confusion about that. But clemency is a cover-all term, that when the president uses the pardon power, there's several forms of clemency that he can use. For example, one of the lesser used ones is remission of fines. If you were supposed to pay a fine, the president can free you of that obligation. But the two that come up the most are commutations and pardons. And commutation only affects a sentence. With a commutation, the president can say, you were supposed to do life, we're going to let you out now. And that's what we saw President Obama using primarily, was commutations for long-term narcotics prisoners. Now, pardon is different. The pardon goes to the conviction that it frees the person from the legal effects of having been convicted of the crime. So not only are they unable, they're free of a sentence, but the rights that are taken away when you're convicted, like the ability to possess a firearm, the right to vote, are returned to you.
But then we have these famous political pardons of people who haven't even been served any time yet. Joe Arpaio, right. Obviously the sheriff in Arizona, but then Gerald Ford's pardon of Nixon and others, and Nixon hadn't been indicted for anything. So what's going on there?
With Nixon, you could make the argument that that was for national reconciliation. And of course, that's what Ford put forward. And what a lot of people believed at the time was that for our nation to heal after Watergate, a lengthy criminal trial was going to be the antithesis to what was needed. Now with Arpaio, you have a different situation because you can't really claim national reconciliation. And, yeah, you know, as you had with some degree at Nixon, you had an underlying problem too with this kind of pardon, which is that normally the process, whether it's a commutation or a pardon, is that the person seeks that mercy. And part of it is contrition, that they are accepting responsibility for what they did. And when we were working with people with commutations under the Obama initiative, part of what we had to do was help them express not only contrition, but what harm their actions had caused within the community. And that's missing here. And part of what we lose there is the spiritual value of the whole thing, because it's lacking that contrition.
So, Mark, you founded the country's first federal clemency clinic at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. What are the kind of things that you guys work on?
Well, it was really specifically founded for a reason, and that was that for a long time in this country, we punished crack much more harshly than powder cocaine. You got the same sentence for 1 gram of crack as 100 grams of powder cocaine in the federal system. And then that changed. In 2010, the law changed, and that was made more even. But it wasn't made retroactive. So you had about 5,000 people who were serving time in prison who would be out today under the law that now existed. Some of those people were doing life who would be free. And so when we started the clinic, it was to try to advocate for those people, to try to get them free through clemency. Part of that was telling their stories, and part of it was going to the White House and trying to talk them into making a broader initiative and, with collaborators like Nikichi Taifa of Open Society. And ultimately that worked. The president did start a program, and our process, was to take on the cases, meet the people. I sent the students out to spend 2 days in the prison with our clients. And tell the rest of their story, because you know what society knows is two things: their name and their crime. And of course, there's a lot that comes before that, but more importantly, there's a lot that comes after that. That so many times, once we got in there, what we found was a turning point in that person's life. Now, sometimes we didn't, and we didn't take those cases, but the people who had made a move towards redemption, towards reconciliation, towards healing themselves, those were the cases that we love taking and that were most often successful.
So you have sort of a fascinating journey because you started as an assistant U.S. attorney and you were actually prosecuting these drug cases. How did you go from you know, doling out very harsh punishments to sort of getting on the other side of it? What was that journey like?
Yeah, I mean, I was a true believer. I was a student at Yale Law School in Professor Dan Freed's sentencing class, and Professor Freed was one of the people who really drove the initiation of the sentencing guidelines in the first place. But then he turned against them. By the time I took that class, I was, you know, one of the few people that really was for it and for, you know, mandatory minimums, frankly. And when I was a prosecutor, I pushed for those. And this was in Detroit, where I'm from. But something happened, and part of what happened was that some of the defense attorneys that I was up against would make what they called the futile speech, where even when the sentence was mandatory, they'd make the argument about how much worse this was going to make things in the African-American community, what it was going to do to harm that particular individual, how someone else would be in that person's place in the next couple of days. And even though it never worked, it was a futile speech and the sentencing was mandatory, it eventually worked on me. And I was convinced that while many of the cases and sentences I was pursuing were justified, that the narcotics cases, especially the crack cases, we were doing the wrong thing. And when I left the office, I started to work on the other side against that 100-to-1 ratio, and ultimately for clemency for some of these people. And of course, that, you know, that pulled me into a fascinating place where it brought me into contact with, you know, a whole new world of advocates inside prison and outside of prison.
Now, you're an Episcopalian, and you've written on Christianity. How does your faith play a role in your belief about clemency? And were you as committed a Christian when you were a prosecutor as you are now, or has that been an evolution as well?
I think it has been an evolution, and I think now I'm fortunate to be in a place where my faith and my work are really of a whole. Yeah, absolutely. That you know, you look at the Constitution, and one of the things that you know really bugs me is when people say that the Constitution is founded in Christian values or Judeo-Christian values. And the truth is, it's not a religious document. It's exactly the opposite. But there is something in the Constitution that does walk with my beliefs and frankly with the many Jews that I work with on these things, which is that mercy is a faith virtue, that the way we treat those others around us, even those who aren't like us, is part of how we make the world whole. And you know, mercy is writ into the pardon power. That's what it's for. And we've seen that from the very start. The first person to use the pardon power was George Washington. And he led an army against the leaders of the Whiskey Rebellion. They killed some people out in western Pennsylvania. And then when they were sentenced to death, he pardoned them. And that's kind of extraordinary. And that is something that goes beyond most other legal issues because there's such a strong spiritual element to it.
So words like redemption, which is coming up a lot with these people, is there a spiritual element to it? Like, is that part of how you do show that you understand what you did and that you are changing? Is invoking God, is that part of both the personal process and also the, you know, like appeal process?
You know, for some people it is, and for a lot of people it isn't. I mean, I'd say it's maybe when I say redemption, I'm talking about my own too, that I'm the person, one of the people who enforced these laws, those tough sentences. And now I'm able to see some of these people walk free. But in terms of their own redemption, their own reconciliation with society, a lot of times it's not faith, it's other things. I mean, I've had two different people that I've talked to recently who were doing life terms and got out under Obama with a commutation. And both told me the same thing when I asked about the turning point in their life. That is, when I went to prison, I read a book for the first time. And then they didn't stop reading books. You know, it's not unusual for me that what I end up talking to people about when they get out of prison is literature. And so it takes different avenues, but almost always there is this turning point.
Mark Osler, thank you for being our Gentile of the Week. If people want to learn more about your work at your clemency clinic, where can they go?
Well, if you Google my name, a bunch of stuff will come up, and there's been you know, a few profiles are worthwhile that are floating around out there, and of course on the St. Thomas website, there's information about the clinic and some of the things I've done.
Well, a happy Jewish New Year to you.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, just about being Gentile of the Week, I was a camp counselor at Camp Akiba in Pennsylvania, and I was the Gentile of the summer, the only Gentile working there. So
I have to say there's a good chance that some of your campers are listening right now. So we will put you guys in touch.
Okay, I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks, Professor.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Bye. And if Mark Osler was your camp counselor, write us and let us know.
We'll send the mail on.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows.
Vanessa Zoltan is the co-host of the mega hit podcast Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. She's a graduate of Harvard Divinity School and is now writing a book on Jane Eyre as a sacred text. She's a dog owner, and most important, she's a former guest on Unorthodox. And she had this story to tell about an apology that didn't quite work.
My cousin Zoe is 6 years older than me, and we were raised like sisters. We went on vacations together. We did sleepovers regularly and Shabbat dinner together every week. I grew up worshiping her, her boyfriends, her dancing skills, her very strong work ethic, and her brown lipstick was amazing. When she got her driver's license at 16, she picked me up first. And as we got older, Zoe allowed our age gap to narrow. By the time she got married, which was 13 years ago, I was 22 and she was 28. And I really felt like we were friends. She treated me as her cousin, but not her baby cousin. Getting married was very important to Zoe. She grew up in a more conservative Jewish household than I did. And so at 28, she felt a real sense of urgency around getting married. When her boyfriend proposed, she was thrilled. She was in the car on her way home from her proposal when she called me that she and her now husband were engaged. And it was on that call that she asked me to be her maid of honor. Of course, I said. I was so excited. So as her maid of honor, I got straight to work planning her bridal shower. I had just graduated from college, so money was tight. So my mom helped me with the planning and with the paying for things. Thanks, Mom. A few weeks before the shower, though, Zoe called me. I was in St. Louis. She called from LA, where she lived. And she told me that she was so sorry, but that she and her fiancé decided to have a bridal party with only their siblings. She said that his extended family was so big and the politics were just getting so complicated, it would just be easier if it was just siblings. Great, I said. I totally understood, and I really did. Family politics around weddings are real. So a few weeks later, I flew out to LA to throw her her shower, and then about 2 months after that, I flew back to LA to go to her wedding. The wedding was a huge, fancy affair, but even in all the chaos, as soon as I arrived, it pretty quickly became clear to me that there was a bridal party, and it wasn't just of siblings. I just wasn't in it. I saw Zoe's close friends and her future in-laws, not just siblings, all wearing matching black dresses. I found my mom and I told her, and she said, "No, no, all of the black dresses are just a coincidence." Surely enough, the procession began, and I was right. It wasn't a pleasant wedding for me, but I didn't say a word to anyone about it. But even though I didn't say anything, the following morning, I got a call from Zoe sobbing and apologizing profusely. My mother had told my grandfather, who had told my aunt, who had told Zoe. Through her tears, Zoe explained that she had decided to go from no bridal party to one without cousins. The wedding politics around cousins were really complicated on her husband's side of the family. I told her that that was fine, but she should have just called me and told me so I wouldn't have been taken by surprise at the wedding. She agreed immediately. She said she'd been really nervous to call about disappointing me. She also said that she had a cancer scare a few days before the wedding, which made her too busy to call. It seemed a funny thing to say because the bridesmaids' dresses didn't look like they'd been thrown together in just a few days, but I asked about her mole. They'd removed it with clean margins and she was fine. Turns out it was a precancerous mole. Good. I don't remember exactly what I said on that phone call, but I know that I forgave her pretty early in the conversation. And I definitely did not forgive her because I'm magnanimous, and it certainly wasn't because I wasn't hurt. I think I mostly did it because I like to be a little smug and superior. One of my favorite theologians, Stephanie Paulsell, says that forgiveness is a gesture of hope for the future, hope that people really can change. And I do think that that is what real forgiveness is. Mine with Zoe was not that. It was acceptance of good enough, not hope for more. It was a performance of forgiveness so that we could just talk about something else. And to be honest, there was just a little bit of spite in me. I thought to myself, well, now I know. I felt like she had given me information about our relationship. We weren't friends. I was still just her baby cousin. More than anything, my forgiveness was strategic. She would be in my life forever. There's already so much family drama. Why not just forgive her and move on? It would make everything just so much more pleasant. I might as well just suck it up and not care. It was just a wedding. But my mother, to this day, cannot forgive Zoe. I mean, it is 13 years later, and their relationship has not been repaired. They do not speak. They didn't acknowledge each other at my brother's wedding, which was 2 years ago, and that was the last time they were in the same room, even though they live 3 miles away from each other. My mom will tell you that Zoe's betrayal was different for her than it was for me. Firstly, my mom helped raise Zoe. Zoe and her brother joined our family on vacations. My dad taught Zoe how to drive. My mom would say that her relationship with Zoe was different from mine and that my mom deserved better from her. My mom will also tell you that she couldn't stand the look of hurt and betrayal in my eyes when I came to her and told her that there were bridesmaids. And I sort of get that. I was embarrassed in that moment, and it had stung. And that's a hard thing to watch, someone embarrassing themselves. When 12-year-old Marsha Brady told her dentist that she had a crush on him, I had to turn off the TV and go scream into a pillow. I couldn't stand to watch her humiliate herself. So I feel for my mom. Now, when I come into town to see my family, seeing Zoe is just logistically difficult. She and my mom don't talk, so we can't do group things, and everyone has kids, so it's harder and harder to see people in the isolated silos that my mom and Zoe each require. So at this point, the person I'm mad at is obviously my mom. When in doubt, be mad at mom, I always say. I wonder, in truth, if my mom can sense that my forgiveness of Zoe is a bit fake, and so she's carrying some of my hurt for me. I wasn't hurt about the wedding. I was embarrassed that I thought that Zoe and I were closer than we were, and maybe my mom knows that. But then I think, stop being an idiot, Vanessa. Mom's pissed about 9,000 other things that Zoe's done, that my aunt's done, that my grandfather has done. But all of those things are complicated and a lifetime of hurt in a big, messy family. But this, on the other hand, this is so clear. That bride messed with my mom's kid. And no one messes with my mom's kid. Forgiveness is for those who hurt other people's kids.
That was Vanessa Zoltan, co-host of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text podcast. That segment was produced by Ariana Nettleman. Hey, J. Crew. A few months ago, we put out a call for you to send in your stories of atonement and apology for this Yom Kippur episode. And we got some great, great letters. We're going to share two of them with you today. Stephanie, what do you have for us?
This comes in from Sherry in New Jersey. It's a really, really interesting one. As a teenager, my first paid job was to babysit my younger cousin when he got home from school. I got to his house before he got home and was responsible for giving him a snack, keeping him occupied, and generally making sure he stayed alive until dinner. For this task, I was paid $15 a week. In the mid-70s, this kept me in record albums and the occasional trip to Friendly's and was well worth the effort. My cousin was in kindergarten and was generally easy to take care of. The snacks were good. However, one day he did something that got on my last nerve, and I spanked him. We did not do spanking in general in my family, and I knew I was not supposed to hit him while babysitting. Now, he did not tell on me. There were no consequences. Nobody ever mentioned it again. But I always remembered it, and I always felt bad about it. My cousin and I remained close and kept in close touch. My family experienced a wave of tragedy. My parents and brother passed away, and he became more like a brother to me every year. But somewhere in the back of my mind, there was always this memory of having hit him, and I still felt guilty about it. One Yom Kippur a few years ago, I decided it was time to apologize and ask forgiveness. I worked up my courage, prepared a whole speech, and laid out my apology. He had absolutely no memory of it at all. In fact, he questioned the possibility that it ever happened. So I guess I was forgiven, though he is going to have to ask my forgiveness for laughing at my apology. Eventually.
Oh, Sherry.
I know.
Let yourself off the hook. All right, I've got one. This one comes from Michael Cantor. He writes, my apology story is more about a friend of mine, whom I've known since I was 10, facilitating my apology to him. His father, who was also my orthodontist, died suddenly in his sleep about 20 years ago. I was just starting medical school, and one of our mutual friends called to tell me what happened. I actually bought a sympathy card, but didn't know what to write and never called. Even when I was home that winter and my mom suggested we go over to their house, I didn't go because by then I was too embarrassed and guilty. Though we'd see each other occasionally at mutual friends' events, we didn't talk except to be civil. Needless to say, we missed each other's weddings. About 10 years later, I heard from him. He was coming to New York for a conference and asked if I wanted to meet. It was September. We went out to lunch and reconnected like old times. I was finally mature enough to apologize for my actions and afterwards sent him an email thanking him for letting me atone for my actions right around Yom Kippur. Since then, we've always been roommates on our annual Vegas trip. He hosted my whole family when I ran the Austin Marathon, and we've been at all of our kids' bar and bat mitzvahs. Yours, Michael Cantor. That is so sweet, and it shows – it shows Stephanie that it's like it never is too late, right? Like, don't let an old friendship die because of some little slight.
And that's actually the rare example when like it actually did happen, right? Like both parties were aware of it and it definitely had consequences. And no, I think it's very true. And for the other person who obviously experienced this great tragedy and didn't have one of their friends there, like to then be the person who basically reconnects, I think it shows that it's the opposite. We need to do, we don't just have to ask for forgiveness. We have to accept others who are like, you know, accept the forgiveness, or we don't have to just ask for forgiveness from others. We have to, you know, grant forgiveness to others as well.
Exactly. Yeah, Maimonides says that if you apologize three times and the person still doesn't accept your apology, at that point they're the ones who are in the wrong. Like you don't have to accept it the first time if you're not quite ready yet, although it's good to. But if they come back three times with three witnesses each time and then you still don't, then you're bad, because it's your job to it's a job to offer forgiveness as well. Like the point is for people to come together again. Okay, we thought that instead of doing Mazel Tovs of the week, we would do some apologies or atonement requests of the week. Stephanie, what do you have?
So a few years ago, I moved into the apartment that I live in now in the West Village, and there was a broker who represented the apartment and who I had to, you know, work with and pay to get the keys, essentially. And he was nice. He liked Tablet a lot. He actually came to the Tablet office to drop the keys off, which I think was just, you know, he didn't have to do. It was nice. And then, of course, I had to pay him the perfunctory 15%, which was, you know, obscene. But it was a, you know, totally nice experience. And then he friended me on Facebook. And I was sort of just like, no, we're not like, we don't need to be Facebook friends. This was like a transactional thing. And I don't necessarily know that you need like that we need to have this connection. And so that was sort of my gut response. And so I didn't accept it. And I sort of never think about it again, except when I get a new friend request and I sort of see his name at the bottom. And as time went on, especially, you know, it's 3 years later and that name is still sitting there, because I don't have the heart to decline it. So it's just sort of in this like limbo, this liminal place. And I feel bad about it, because I'm just sort of thinking, why didn't I just confirm him and just, you know, forget this whole thing ever happened? But part of me, I don't know, I just at the time, it just felt like an important stance to make. And so I just, he's there in my limbo, and I want to get him out of it. But I just worry that it's too late to confirm him. But I might do that this year.
All right. I think you should. I think it's never too late to confirm somebody as a Facebook friend. And as you say this, I'm clicking through all of mine. And I will add to that, you know, similarly, a fan of Unorthodox. This is my apology. A big fan of Unorthodox came up to us after our taping at Beth Zedek Synagogue in Toronto, and he handed me a book that his father wrote. And he just said, you know, my father was this mid-century Jewish novelist. You probably haven't heard of him, but I think you'd enjoy this book. And the book was called The Landsman, and it was by Peter Martin. But I forget the son's name, and I haven't been able to find him. And I basically have wanted to write him a note saying, I haven't read your dad's book yet, but it is literally on my night table, and I want to read it, and it looks good, and I'm so touched that you thought to give it to us. And this just brings up all of the people who reach out to us because we are semi-public figures in really meaningful ways that we don't forget, that we actually carry around with us, but like the Facebook request, we just don't act on it. And in this case, I forgot the guy's name and email, but this is really for all of you out there who have reached out in some way and we've dropped the ball. It's not that we don't care or didn't notice, and it's really sustaining and wonderful that you do it. So to Stephanie's broker and to Peter Martin's son.
I'm sorry. That was just a stupid thing to do.
We'll do better in the new year.
Ya te borré del corazón, ya para siempre. Ya te borré de mi existir completamente.
Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Please send us mail. It's the highlight of all of our lives, getting your letters. And we read them all, even if we can't respond to every last one of them. But we do read them all. We talk about them. We share them. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. You can follow Stephanie on Instagram at sbutnick. We are on Facebook a lot. Just follow Tablet Magazine's Facebook page. Our executive producer is Alyssa Goldstein, and we are also produced by Shira Telushkin. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger, and our show is edited by Noah Levinson. Our music is by Golem. Rabbinic supervision is by Rabbi Jack Romberg of Temple Israel in Tallahassee. Kosher slaughtering by those not sealed in the Book of Life this year. We record at Argo Studios, which never has to say it's sorry, and we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.
The funny thing is, like, to me, New Year's resolutions, like the January, the Gregorian kind, mean nothing. But right. I do like at the beginning of, you know, at the high holidays, it's like, I like to sort of think about what the who the person I want to be is. And it was last night I was saying to Ben, I was like, this year I want to do something. I actually have no idea what it was. I should have written it down. But I was like, I want to be more something, or I want to do less something. And so it's like, I guess it didn't take because I have no idea what it was. And it was like right before I went to sleep. But yeah, hopefully I'll be that this year.